This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at the Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2025, held at United Christian School in Napanee, Indiana, on February 28 and March 1, 2025.
I find it somewhat ironic that y'all got a good look at the natural world with my screensaver there for a while. Right before we learn about science. So, I was going to introduce myself, but that's already been taken care of. It's always uncomfortable to introduce yourself anyway. So, yes, I'm James Geary. Worked at Christian Light for a little over 10 years at this point. So, when you're preparing for a talk like this, you want to have an engaging story to start with. I thought and could not come up with one. And then I realized that we are in the middle of an engaging story right now. A story with good guys, villains, saviors, false gods, and false messiahs. And you may be wondering, what does this have to do with science? But trust me, we'll get there eventually. So let's look here at Gospel of Matthew. And I'll go ahead and read through this here. Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. The many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." So we are in the end times, I believe. It's possible we've been in the end times since shortly after Christ was raised from the grave. But I think it's clear that we are. There's turmoil, conflict, creation is broken. Disease, pestilence, just years ago we were reminded of that. And here are a few of the things that Jesus says. There'll be false prophets come to deceive. There'll be conflict between nations, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, false prophets, lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold, there'll be apostasy. But there's always hope. So he tells us, take heed that no one deceives you. We need to be paying attention. We can't be lying down on the job. We need to be awake. See that you're not troubled. Don't be afraid. Because at the end there, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. So, what does this have to do with science? It's because I want to look a little bit at what our students are facing. I think that seeing what our students will be facing in coming decades is important in helping us think about why we teach science, and a little bit about what we teach and how we teach it. Now, I'm not going to be getting a lot into the how and the what, but you can certainly extrapolate from some of the why that we'll be talking about here. So one of the things we're dealing with is secularization, and this is in society, it's even coming into our churches. We also are dealing with polarization. You'll only have to look at the news to see how far apart many people are. There's conflict, maybe not physical conflict, but verbal conflict. Politics has become a new religion for many people, and a lot of our students are getting pulled into that sort of thing. Sadly, because sometimes we get pulled into it ourselves. You probably knew about all those already. The other one here is the erosion of authorities. It used to be that, if you had a question, you went to a trusted person that you knew. You would go to an encyclopedia, a dictionary, go to a doctor for advice if you're not feeling very good. Well, now we don't look to any of those things. We do our own research. And sometimes, I'm sure you all know people personally, they do their own research, but then what they decide to do doesn't seem very wise. Next one is kind of a new term for me, epistemic overload. So epistemology is the study of truth and how to discover truth. So epistemic overload, or epistemic overload, is the difficulty of discerning truth due to the quantity of information. And I think that's, sometimes when we're talking about the internet, we think about some of the impure influences that come. That is a concern. But sometimes I think we don't realize how much just this, the simple volume of information. Used to be you could go to those authorities and they could tell you what the right thing was. Now you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 different perspectives you have to sift through. Our students are going to have to deal with that in coming years and decades. So thinking about this, why do we teach science? We need to be thinking about our goals. What are our goals for science education? Because that'll tell us how we teach it and what we teach. So before we discuss the why, we need to look at the overall goals. What are we aiming for? What is going to guide what we teach and how we teach it? One thing that you can think about is, what sort of student are we wanting to produce? What sort of student are we wanting to produce? And I'm just going to let you think about that a little bit here. What student are we wanting to produce? What knowledge do we want them to have? What skills do we want them to gain? These are all things we should be thinking about, not just in science, but since this is my topic, this is what I chose. And I think we can get a lot of help with this question from the greatest teacher, Christ. Let me go ahead and read this here. But one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he answered well, asked him, "Which is the first commandment of all?" Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." So this is from the Gospel of Mark. And Jesus here is quoting from Deuteronomy 6, specifically Deuteronomy 6:4. It's a prayer of the Jews. Jews oftentimes would recite this every single day. It's oftentimes, in Jewish culture, it's called the Shema. Maybe you've heard that term. Shema means hear. It's a transliteration of the Hebrew word hear, because it starts out with, "Hear, O Israel." So I think we can get the core of why we should teach science from these two commandments: love God and love your neighbor. If we don't move our students toward loving God and loving our neighbors, then we have failed. And I believe that science and a study of science can help us to fulfill both of those goals. So, kind of summarizing here, what are our goals? We want students to be lovers and worshipers of God. That's first, that's foremost. Number two, lovers and servants of nature, of neighbors. And I added these others on here, just kind of a bonus. Clear thinking and discerning, kind of what I mentioned earlier, how you have this information overload. We live in the information age. There's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, propaganda. We need our students to be clear thinking and discerning. And science, I think part of that is part of that education. It's not the only thing, but it's part of it. And the last one, capable yet humble. We want our students to gain that knowledge and those skills in science that they can make decisions, that they can do well at their jobs, they can make good decisions as parents. All of you who are parents have had to deal with sick children. You have to make decisions. Do we take them to the doctor? Do we not? Do we use antibiotics? Do we not? What do we do? And having science skills can help our students as they move into different roles in their lives. Now, before we go much further, I want to talk about what is science. And this might seem like a duh question, but it's not. We oftentimes see science as a body of knowledge. It's you've got your facts about chemistry, your facts about physics, your facts about biology, astronomy, earth science. You go on and on and kind of filter that down more and more specific, not just biology, microbiology, not just chemistry, organic chemistry. There's an almost infinite amount of knowledge in science. I think partially because the world was created by an infinite God. But I do not think this is a good definition of science. I think it's the body of knowledge is the findings of science. It is not science itself. Science is instead a way of investigating the natural world. It's a method. You've heard the scientific method. Step one, do this. Step two, do this. Step three, step four, step five. There's different variations on that. But I would say that is the core of what science is. It's a process for looking at the natural world, asking good questions, insightful questions, coming up with experiments, testing whether our questions or our hypotheses are correct, adjusting. Science is a process of investigating. So understanding the natural world can help us develop a lot of useful technologies. So sometimes science and technology are kind of lumped together. Science is the knowledge, the understanding of the natural world. Technology is the application of that. So microchip is not science, it's technology. But it took scientific knowledge to be able to make that microchip. So here's just a few types of technology that science has given us. Fabrics, pottery, iron smelting, paper and printing, antibiotics, space flight, GPS, internet, and computers that are quite likely in your pockets right now. One thing that's interesting, Christians tend to be a little bit resistant, or at least us as conservative Anabaptists, we tend to be a little bit resistant, a little bit hesitant on technology. What's interesting is some of the early Christians were cutting edge when it came to technology. They were some of the first people to really popularize the Codex, which is a book. Before then, it was largely scrolls. But they latched onto that technology of a book. I don't think of a technology, maybe don't think of a book as technology, but it is. Another thing, sometimes you hear the term science, the way people use it, follow the science. It's seen as an authority. It's an authority, and you either accept it or you reject it. And I also think this is a pretty thin understanding of what science is. So I don't agree with that. What tends to happen if we look at science as an authority, this vague authority, science says you should do this, or science says you shouldn't do this, we tend to either accept it or reject it, depending on some of our biases or prior beliefs or the culture we come from, whatever the case might be. It's more nuanced than that. So I don't think we should view it as an authority. Science is done by flawed humans trying to understand the natural world. You know, since sin has entered the world, we're imperfect. We have biases. We have blind spots. And so science, you should expect science to be wrong, scientists to be wrong, because they're just as flawed as we are. In some ways, possibly even more so. We have Christ. Some of them don't. So when I talk about science, throughout the rest of this talk, I'll be talking about the scientific method and the findings of science. That's what I'll be talking about. So, why teach science? Here we actually finally get to the question I'm supposed to be talking about. We live in a physical world. God said it was good. If God said that it's good, then why shouldn't we study it? But the world is broken because of sin. Not long after, I mean, we don't know the exact amount of time, but it doesn't seem like it was very long after creation. Adam and Eve sinned, and not just their own bodies, their own lives were broken, but creation was broken. God told Adam, you know, you're going to have to sweat, you're going to have to work to provide for yourself. He told Eve that you're going to have pain in childbirth, and we're still dealing with the effects of that fall. And science helps us to better understand the world we live in, helps us understand how it's broken, and helps us to adapt to that. helps us grow food, build shelter, clothe ourselves, do all these other things that we need to deal with the effects of the fall. So, now we're getting to the first big reason. Science helps us love and worship God. So how can science do that? So here is probably one of the most well-known verses talking about seeing God in the creation. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day into day utters speech, and night into night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard, their lines going out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So here we see that nature speaks. We can read the book of nature in a lot of ways. And here it's speaking of God. So if we want to have a relationship with somebody, we want to know who they are. We want to know what they like, what makes them laugh. And we can learn about God through his creation. We don't think about it much in our modern light-polluted society, but ancient peoples watched the night sky much more than we do, and they developed stories and myths to explain why the star patterns were there. Science historians believe that astronomy was the first real systematic science that was developed. It was ancient people looking up at the stars and watching them move through the seasons and seeing these little stars that moved around, didn't follow the others, what we now know as planets. The ancient Babylonians, Egyptians, Chinese, and even the indigenous Americans here in North, Central, and South America all had fairly well-developed astronomy. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So creation speaks to us to the extent that we don't have an excuse if we don't believe in a creator, what it's saying here. Modern atheism, the belief in there not being a God or a creator, as far as I know, somebody can correct me later if I'm wrong, it's a relatively modern movement. Ancient cultures, almost, as far as I know, without exception, believed in some sort of power that created the world. A lot, and you know, most of them were mistaken as to who this power, this God was. But creation was speaking to them. They could tell there was something behind it. So, seeing attributes of God in creation, sometimes called general revelation, in contrast to special revelation. If we understand a little bit of the vastness of the universe, we can see how immense God is. If we see the complexity and interconnectedness of living things on this earth as well, we can see the creativity of the Creator and his provision for life. Science also helps us, or it should, lead to a proper view of man in relation to God. I talked earlier that we want our students to be capable, yet humble. And that yet humble is pretty important. If our students are capable, but they're proud, then they have failed. So it's important to have a proper understanding of God and man. Psalm 8. So here again, this is looking at the heavens, but it kind of puts us in our place. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? You have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. So here we're seeing that man is so small that we can't even imagine how God can even look at us or even know that we exist. But we are specially made by God. So that helps us kind of see where we are in relation to God and also in relation to the rest of the creation. I'll talk a little bit more about some of the dangers of scientific knowledge later, so I'll just leave that here for now. So science helps us love and serve our neighbors. So we talked about how science can help us love God and worship him. So now let's see how it can help us love and serve our neighbors. So I'm not going to read this, but this here, specifically Genesis 1:28, is what is often called the dominion mandate, that God told Adam and Eve, I've given this world to you. I want you to take it and use it. It said, subdue it and have dominion over these living things. And to have dominion, we need to understand those living things. We need to understand, in a sense, what makes them tick. We need to understand how plants grow, to be able to grow them for food. We need to understand how animals grow and how to keep them healthy if we're going to use them for meat and milk and cheese and other food. So science is currently the best way we know of to learn about the natural world and help us to subdue and use it. And so for that reason, I feel like it is imperative that we teach science to our students. You know, each one of them is created in the image of God. Each one of them carries that burden of the dominion mandate. And so I believe that they need to have some scientific knowledge to do that. Just a few verses after Genesis 1:28, God put Adam in the garden, and he said, to keep and dress it. What does keep and dress mean? I think it gives you the picture of taking care of. You know, Adam wasn't going in there and chopping down trees and ripping all the apples off the trees. He was taking care of it. You know, he was pruning. This was before there were any pests and so forth. But I can imagine after the fall, he was still keeping and dressing the creation. So to properly care for creation, we need to know the principles by which the natural world operates. We need to know that if we dump used motor oil in the stream, that that's going to have an adverse effect on not just the animals and the wildlife in the stream, but it's going to actually damage those that are downstream of us, both literally and figuratively. In other words, if we use creation improperly, we're going to harm our neighbors. And so that's why I think that scientific knowledge can help us love our neighbors. Caring for creation shows love to our neighbors. My grandfather Gary was born in 1933, in April, in the middle of one of the largest dust storms in the Dust Bowl. He's been gone for about 13 years now, but that was something I always remembered. He was born during one of those dust storms. And some of these dust storms during the Dust Bowl were so large that the dust would actually blow completely across the country to Washington, D.C., New York City, to the extent that they would have to turn on their headlights during the day so they wouldn't run into each other with their vehicles. And so you can see some pictures here. There's many other pictures. Why was this? Why did this Dust Bowl happen? Well, there's a couple different factors. Some, there wasn't really any way we could have done anything differently. But farmers went out west and continued farming just like they did back east. They got their plows out, they turned over the earth, and so then they had a couple years of drought, and wind came along and it just blew the dirt. Billions, possibly trillions of tons of topsoil were blown away from that area. It led not only to loss of farmland, but complete devastation for many of those people. There's a really good book called The Worst Hard Time, about the Dust Bowl. I can't remember the writer's name, but if that interests you, I'd definitely check that out. You've probably heard of the Okies. The Okies were escaping the Dust Bowl. Huge, thousands and thousands of people would travel to try to get away from they lost everything. This is something I learned in my research. It was interesting. In March 1935, one of President Roosevelt's, this has been during FDR's time in office, he was testifying before Congress about the need for better soil conservation. And just so happened that it was a day or so after there'd been a dust storm out in the Great Plains, and there was so much soil in the air. He pointed out and said, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And so the Congress passed the Soil Conservation Act before the end of the year. Some of you have maybe not heard of this, but here is Australia's rabbit plague. I'm not sure exactly when it was, but European settlers wanted to go hunting. They enjoyed hunting back in Europe, and they wanted to continue hunting in Australia. And they didn't have any rabbits in Australia to hunt. So they took some rabbits. I think it was about 24 rabbits. But they didn't have any predators. And so they did what rabbits do. They multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. They just killed them and killed them and killed them and killed them. Just to the extent that people actually got tired of killing rabbits. Like, it just, they were tired of doing it. And they still could not kill enough to keep up with the population growth. So eventually what they did is they got a deadly virus that was deadly to rabbits, and they introduced that in the population, and the population crashed by 98-99%. But there were just a couple of rabbits that were resistant to that virus, and then the population exploded again. And to this day, they still deal with rabbits in Australia. I'm not sure if it's rabbits or if it's some other animal that was introduced to Australia, but there's this giant fence that they use to try to keep those animals from making it to the other side of Australia that doesn't have them. Two other examples, those of you who are in the South know about this, but the introduction of kudzu from Japan into the South to help with soil erosion, to keep banks in place and so forth. And it was kind of like ivy over in Japan. And I'm not sure what it was over here. I guess partially they didn't have any insect predators. And it pretty much put kudzu on steroids, and it just grew like you wouldn't believe. Also, in the Everglades, a lot of people would get these exotic snakes, and then when the snake got 6 feet long, they didn't want it anymore, and they would go out to the swamp and dump it in the swamp because they didn't want to kill it. And so now there are many, many thousands of pythons in the Everglades that are devastating the natural population there. So why do I give these examples? I give these examples to show how a misunderstanding or ignorance about how the natural world works can have huge consequences to people. And it's not just an inconvenience. There's people's livelihoods that were completely destroyed because of the Dust Bowl. So just a little bit about environmentalism. So this is something we deal with. Influence. There was a focus on the environment during the 1970s and 80s. One of the books that came out of that was called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. She was talking about the effect of pesticides on wildlife. And so they started cracking down on pesticides. DDT was a pesticide that was very effective that they quit using partially because of that. There were some aspects of environmentalism that were very extreme and put creation before man. But in some areas, they did actually do some good things. And so one of the things that our students are going to have to deal with is navigating some of these governmental policies. Oftentimes, I hear some of our people talking about governmental policies and regulations in a very disparaging way, and they can be very inconvenient for sure. But one thing I think sometimes happens is that conservative politicians push back against environmentalism movement, which tends to come from the liberals, and we tend to align ourselves as religious conservatives. We tend to align ourselves with the political conservatives, and so we tend to have that reaction. And so that has, listening to those voices has bred a similar attitude in our own people. And what tends to happen, not always, but what tends to happen is that reaction against environmentalism breeds its own form of a lack of concern for the environment and a focus on the rights of individuals and our ability to make money. So if we want our students to love our neighbors, I think we need to have science education that encourages them to take care of creation, not to make creation a god, not to put it before humans, but to take care of it. So, what's the solution to environmentalism? I think part of the solution is a proper view of creation in man. Man is above creation, but the physical world is good and is a gift from God. So we need to keep those two things kind of in tension there. We're above creation. The dominion mandate tells us that we can have dominion over it, but it's a good and precious gift. And I think that one of the things that science can do is it can foster wonder and curiosity in our children, in our young people. And if that's the case, I think that can result in a care for, not exploitation, of creation. So I think that, just kind of summarize there, science can help us care more for the gift that God has given us. So here's a few reasons, or a few ways that we carry out the Dominion mandate. Grow food, use natural resources. A knowledge of science helps us to use these resources more sustainably. In the past, when we were governments and businesses were ignorant, they overfished, they overcut timber, and the environment was damaged because of that. But now that we've learned more about how nature works, the systems that God has put in place, we are now, some of our fish populations are rebounding. And I think we have more trees now than we have for many decades. Not far from where I live, where it's now the Skyline Drive, it used to be that was farmland. And it was almost completely clear cut. There was almost no trees there now. And there was a federal bill passed to turn that into a national park. But then they had to move all the farmers off their land. I just heard the other day, I was talking to somebody, they were saying that in an area close to the Shenandoah National Park, that there's still people that are still bitter over the government moving them out of their farms. So, being able to navigate some of those really hard questions, I think is important to understand nature, to understand science. Developing medicines, medical care, passing on a productive earth to future generations. I've sometimes heard before the idea, well, this is all going to burn up anyway. Toss your trash, dump your oil on the ground, that sort of thing. People have been saying that for a long time. And I don't know when the Lord's going to return, but I think it's presumptuous of us to assume that it's all going to burn up in 20 years, and so we don't need to bother to preserve the earth for future generations. I think the Dominion mandate is not exploitative, but it's caring. So that, I feel, is a way that we can use science to love and serve our neighbor. So there are some other reasons for teaching science. I think that learning how to properly view science helps us understand better what science is, what it can do. It also helps us know what it can't do, gives us its limits. It's a powerful tool for understanding the natural world, the physical world, but not the supernatural. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to move on here, running out of time. Science is tentative by nature. What do I mean by that? I mean that we learn, we're constantly learning about creation. We learn a little bit more, and then we might find out that what we thought was right is actually not right. Years ago, it used to be that people would say, well, eggs are bad for you. Well, now they're good for you, they say. Saturated fat is bad. Now it's good. Well, why is that? It's not just because scientists are being capricious and trying to play with us. It's because as we learn more, we have to adjust our thinking. My grandfather, Gehring, was often quoted saying, a wise man changes his mind. And if we're faced with new evidence, shouldn't we change our minds as well? Here's a few other things. How to think, observe, test, and solve problems in an orderly way. Our children are going to be facing a lot of problems, a lot of choices. And learning the scientific method and how science works can help them better understand how to think through in a systematic way those problems. Gives life knowledge. I won't spend too much time on that. You all likely know that already. And then this other one here helps understand the relationship between science and faith. This is one I feel is also very important, even though I didn't make it into the two big goals of loving God and loving neighbor. Secular science in our society has become a bit of a god. It's that authority that we need to accept. For many people, it becomes that. And so what we tend to do is we tend to, well, science is also sometimes used by people to try to refute God. And so what we tend to do is we tend to react against that and start rejecting it. If people are worshiping science as a God and they're trying to use it to refute God, we're just going to have nothing to do with it. And so I feel a healthy view of science, understanding how it works, not just the knowledge, I feel is really important, keeping us from becoming science skeptics. You know, many of the early scientists believed that creation actually confirmed their faith. And it's only pretty recently, since about the mid-1800s, that it started to make that shift away from studying the creation, tells us about the Creator, to studying the world, moves us away from God. That's a pretty recent movement. Sir Isaac Newton said, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." So that's Isaac Newton, quite likely probably one of the most prodigious and most impactful scientists that we know. You know, modern science has tried to put forth ideas to that attempt to remove the need for a divine creator. But what's actually ended up happening is, in some ways, as we have gotten better and better measurements, or better and better instruments, to see smaller and smaller things, we've actually moved to where it's less and less plausible that this could happen by chance. Used to be that they thought cells were just these kind of blobs of protoplasm, not very complicated. But now we know that they're intricate cities made up of nanoscale machines. There's Francis Crick, who is the discoverer of the structure of DNA in the 1950s or 60s, I believe, wrote in a magazine, he said, "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved." Something to think about there. So he would have been an atheist, but he had to keep reminding himself, it looks like it's designed, but it's actually not. So science can actually very much confirm our faith, strengthen our faith. I really feel like if we move away from it, that we have that we're losing something. Okay, why not teach science? I'm not sure if the committee was expecting me to talk about this, but I will throw this here out just to kind of balance things a little bit. I would say the main reason is because man has this tendency to set himself up as a god. And I would see this happening all the way back in the Garden of Eden. Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." See that phrase there, "you will be like God." There has been that temptation ever since creation for us to start putting ourselves, wanting to get up to where God is. And I think that will never go away. That is a danger, and it's something we need to be very careful of. There's the Tower of Babel. There again, you had these people that had technology. Says there, they found a plain, they dwelt there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks." Bricks are technology. "Bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves. Let us become like a god." And so God came and confused their language. When we chase after knowledge and power, we often begin to worship ourselves in the created world instead of the Creator. And I think the perfect section of Scripture to talk about that comes directly after Romans 1, verse 20. "Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness and lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves." Studying science can make us feel superior. It can kind of make us feel kind of puffed up. And that's something we don't want our students to do. That's why I said capable yet humble. Maybe I should say humble and capable. put the capable last, I don't know. But studying science can lead toward humility as we see more of God in creation and as we realize how little we actually are. What is man that thou art mindful of him? There's a quote by John Archibald Wheeler that I've thought about multiple times. We live on an island surrounded by a sea of ignorance. As our island of knowledge grows, so does the shore of our ignorance. As we know more, we realize how little we know. So, in conclusion, why teach science? God has called us to love and worship God and to love and serve our neighbor. And I feel that science can give us a lot of the tools and knowledge and methods that can help us to do both of those. Help us to know God better. Help us to love him more, worship him more. Help us to be able to be aware of the way creation works so we can better love and serve our neighbors. Scientific knowledge helps us see who God is, man's place in creation, and how to help our neighbors. This is the parallel passage in Matthew that I used at the beginning. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So if all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments, can't we hang our study of science on those two commandments? Can there be any higher goal in our school than to fulfill these commandments? May the Lord bless you as you lead teachers and young people in your schools.